Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and here's a guy with a dire prediction.
These stocks will start to become radioactive.
That's Eric Reeves with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. Eric says recent events could lead folks to dump certain company stocks. In fact, he says,
these stocks will start to become radioactive.
So here's a quiz. According to Reeves, which companies will investors avoid like plutonium? Are we talking A, companies who invest in Sudan? President Bush imposed sanctions on the country this week. Or perhaps it's B, mortgage lending companies. With foreclosures on the rise, some could be in big trouble. Or can you get radiation poisoning from C, record company stocks? CD music sales are dropping faster than a needle on vinyl. No clue? No problem. The answer is up next on this week's Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
Your money is a powerful thing. It helps feed, clothe, and house you. It buys you fun toys and takes you interesting places. It can also be a potent political tool. On the show this week, personal divestment. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. Introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com.
This week, President Bush tightened economic sanctions against Sudan, despite criticisms from some analysts who say it won't end the bloodshed in Darfur. But that hasn't stopped individuals from trying to create their own economic sanctions by divesting from the region. Eric Reeves is a professor at Smith College, and he's also an expert on Sudan and the divestment campaign. And Eric, let's start by pointing out that you aren't exactly impartial in this debate. You advise human rights organizations around the world.
Human rights organizations, advocacy groups, and indeed humanitarian organizations as well.
Well, in talking about divestment, one of the main criticisms that we hear is that it really doesn't have a big effect. If that is the case, why should ordinary investors try to alter, say, their mutual funds or their portfolios to avoid companies that do business in these countries?
It's simply wrong to assume that the divestment campaign has had no effect. On the contrary, major European corporations have suspended all operations in Sudan precisely because of this campaign. That's not symbolism. That's efficacy.
What about the opposing argument that perhaps economic investment and development could help a troubled region like this?
If we look back at the last 18 years, none of the investment has been in the marginalized regions or benefiting the marginalized populations of Sudan. Sudan's the size of the United States east of the Mississippi. The only part of Sudan that's seen the benefit of these billions of dollars of foreign investment is a Delaware-sized area around Khartoum, Omdurman, and this very narrow sliver of the Nile River Valley.
Could you compare this situation to, say, the anti-apartheid campaigns of the 80s in South Africa, and how much individual investors and the actions that they took had any sort of effect on what was going on there?
Economists are divided about whether or not the divestment campaign in South Africa had any real effect. But the big difference is electronic communication, the speed with which equity markets, stock markets, are able to assess the views of individual investors, information that may bear on the attractiveness or unattractiveness of a given equity. The two dozen or so European and Asian companies doing business as usual with a genocidal regime have been lit up by means of media coverage, by means of advocacy efforts, in ways that were simply impossible 20 years ago. And it has changed fundamentally the speed with which the markets can assimilate information. And thus, you can see a much more rapid effect on share price. And that's what these companies are most fearful of, a precipitous drop in share price because of the divestment campaign.
So what are some ordinary things that people can do if they decide that they want to have some part in affecting change in Sudan through their bank accounts, through their retirement accounts?
The first and easiest thing to do is simply to call your broker or your investment manager or your pension fund manager and say, am I invested in any of these 24 companies that are complicit in sustaining a genocidal regime through commercial and capital investment? Simply to ask the question is to put all these issues on the radar screen in a big way. These questions may have vague answers or they may not get satisfactory answers, in which case you persist, but the questions will register. If enough people do that, these stocks will start to become radioactive. All of this is covered by the news media. All of this certainly makes its way into the calculations about appropriate share value by traders.
Eric Reeves is a professor of English at Smith College. Thank you so much for coming into the studio. We very much appreciate it.
Very good to be with you.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. And by the NASD Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at NASDFoundation.org.
All right, let's switch up the tone a little bit. For most of us adults, June's just another month. For kids, dude, summer vacation. Luckies. For many kids, summertime is time to stop working and start relaxing. In fact, a recent study from Northeastern University found more teenagers than ever will be relaxing instead of working summer jobs this year. They're getting edged out of the labor market by immigrants and retirees. But as Jeremy Hobson reports, they could be missing out on a lot more than just a paycheck.
It's a hot afternoon in McLean, Virginia, just outside Washington, D.C. The kids are out of school, and many of them are spending the rest of the day here at the pool. It's obviously playtime for some, but work is just beginning for 15-year-old Wes Brandt. He's spending the summer working as a lifeguard and a diving coach.
Start on your right, since you guys are all left-footed. Start on your right. It's a medium-sized step. Yep.
He's teaching younger kids the basics of diving for a little more than minimum wage.
I'm going to probably be at the pool anyways all summer. I might as well be getting paid to do it.
His parents, Lori Garver and Dave Brandt, are with him on that one.
He needs the experience. He's got to get into the real world and keep away from the computer.
Yeah, I think he should do other things. He was happy to get a job. There's a lot of friends that go to the pool as an easy thing to do when he needs to learn to manage his money.
Managing money is not the only thing a teenager can get out of summer employment. John Gallo co-wrote a book called The Financially Intelligent Parent.
Developing a work ethic, which is what you're going to go get from having to show up on time and work with somebody who isn't your parent and isn't your school teacher, really helps kids in later life. It's the most significant predictor of adult mental health.
Gallo says getting these life skills as a teenager can lay the foundation for stability later. Feeling competent, solving problems, and working with other people are all skills that can be gained from summer jobs. He says these skills can help reduce the chances of a midlife crisis or even divorce.
All of those are just very important life lessons for kids to get.
But probably not the things that are driving Wes Brandt. He just wants some extra cash. But Brandt says he knows he's learning something.
My mom doesn't tell me when I have to come work. I have to know when I'm going to come work, and I have to say, hey, do you have my check and stuff like that. I mean, it's not my parents doing everything anymore.
Experts say even unpaid internships can give teenagers a leg up as they apply to colleges and future jobs. But not everyone has the option of going unpaid for a summer.
Most kids work for the same reasons that adults do.
That's Andrew Sum, who directs the Center for Labor Market Studies at Northeastern University.
Being able to have spending money of their own would always go at the top of the list to be able to finance their own consumption. Second thing is particularly what you find is kids from lower-income families are more likely to contribute to their family's well-being. And the other thing that we often find that young people will say is, by working early in my life, what I did find out was what I didn't want to do the rest of my life.
15-year-old Wes Brandt already knows he wants to be a music teacher later on in life, but there's nothing wrong with a little extra cash for the summer. So what's he plan to do with it?
Oh, I don't know. So many options, but probably more video games. StarCraft 2. It's going to be great.
In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace Money.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Fellow shoppers, how did we ever live without the internet? It makes it so easy to figure out which online retailer offers the best price on just about everything. And thanks to some new services, now you can do that same comparison shopping in a bricks and mortar store with your cell phone. Here to tell us about it is our pal Brian Cooley. He's editor at large at CNET. Brian, welcome back.
Thanks. Good to be here.
All right. So I want to be able to go into a store, get the barcode off a nice pair of pants, punch it into my phone, go to the clerk, show him the phone and say, hey, you know what? I can get this down the street or off the internet for 10 bucks less. What can you do for me? Is that what we're talking about here?
Yeah, half of that works. You can okay. definitely do that with these services. Now, getting any result out of that is what's going to be the hard part, in that a large national retailer does not give much power to the local clerk to make a deal.
I assume that there must be some sort of charge for this service. So what am I, as the user, going to pay for it? Is there some sort of monthly service fee?
Well, you shouldn't have to pay to spend your money. That sounds too much like an investment advisor to me. Services like a Frucall is one of them, a take on Frugal and Call. Another one's called Nearby Now. They both appear to be laying off the fees on the merchant. There are services out there, I understand, in development that do charge a fee to the person who's shopping, and perhaps they may be a little more trustworthy. A service that is being paid by merchants perhaps won't list merchants who aren't paying it.
So there's no guarantee that you're actually getting the best price.
No, I mean, I've looked at a couple of these services here and tried them out, and most of them are pretty early, pretty beta right now, but I've tried them out, and on one I went looking for a very common Canon digital camera, and all of the leads that came back were Target.
Hmm.
There's something wrong there. That camera's carried in far more places in my San Francisco Bay Area than just Target.
Okay, but when they worked out the kinks, how exactly are these services supposed to work?
There's one, this one called Nearby Now, is mall-based, and so what they do is they work at a specific mall, and they advise you, literally on the doors of merchants and the mall, hey, as you're shopping around, text, and they tell you how to text a message to their service with the word jeans, or specifically Canon A550 camera, and they will tell you where it's available in the mall at the best price. Frucall tries to get you out of the store to buy online after you feed in the SKU number off a product you're staring at in the store, and they'll say, well, you know, you could buy this online for X amount of bucks, and it's in stock at these sites.
Well, this sounds pretty cool. Let me ask you to look into your crystal ball and tell me what's coming next.
Location-based services are going to be very real, I think. Why would you carry a GPS device if your phone can do on-screen navigation, which it can today? Movie tickets. Why would you have to enter your zip code to find out movies around you? Your phone should know that.
I think at this point it should also name your child.
It does that already. There's a namemykid.com. Yeah, I'm sure it's out there. I just haven't checked it out yet.
Brian Cooley is editor-at-large at CNET. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Tis better to give than to receive, but receiving's even better when you don't have to pay taxes. Chris presents advice in the mailbag, and we gain entry into the spiciest job in New York City.
Probably about once, twice a year, people in the bedroom lock themselves with a handcuff and they lose the key, or the key's too far for them to reach.
Oh my, a day in the work life of a locksmith. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. We Americans spend a lot of money buying stuff. And then we spend more money making sure no one steals the stuff. Last week on the show, we did a cost-benefit analysis of home security systems, alarms, surveillance cameras, that sort of thing. But we overlooked the most humble security device of them all, the lock and key. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we talked to a guy who pays close attention to those very items. He's a locksmith.
I make probably 10, 20,000 keys a year. A lot. Hi, my name is Guy, and I am one of the owners and manager of SOS Locksmith and Advanced Security Systems in New York City. When most people think of locksmith, they probably think about losing their keys or forgetting their keys in the car. What was really a shock to me was how much work we do. We install doors, we fix glass. When doors fall off, we put them back on their hinges. We deal with safes, we deal with ironwork, gates, welding. The people that get locked out and losing keys is really a very small fraction of the actual work that's performed here. It's a family business. It's been here for about 35, 36 years. Since I was a kid, I used to cut keys, and 12 years ago, I started coming around here more often. I kind of liked it, so I've been here ever since. The favorite thing about this job is there's constantly new people, constantly going to different places. We see the best of both worlds. We see when people move into their apartments and they need to change their locks and their hardware just for safety's sake. And then we see, you know, when a boyfriend and a girlfriend break up or somebody gets divorced and they need to change their locks. The most bizarre thing was probably about once, twice a year, people in the bedroom lock themselves with a handcuff and they lose the key, or the key's too far for them to reach. On the other end of the spectrum, though, we've opened apartment doors where there's dead people. So, seen everything. My salary is approximately $100,000. An average locksmith salary, it's probably anywhere between $40,000 to $60,000 a year. Then you have people that provide emergency services. Technicians that work at night will make a substantial amount more, probably double, if the company has enough work to provide. I think one of the great things about this type of business, I would never have to worry about job security. Just like everybody has milk in their refrigerator and water to drink, everybody has a key. Even though we deal with a lot of electronic and keyless products and wireless products, there's millions and billions and I could even say trillions of keys in this country. Every year, on a consistent level, we sell more and more deadbolts and we install more locks for people. There will never be any worry in terms of job security. Oh boy, you're going to embarrass me now. Did I ever lock myself out of anywhere? Yes, I did. Actually, when I moved into my new apartment, when I was bringing up boxes, I did slam the door behind me. I called one of my friends, and they came and they helped me open the door. It was very cheap. Yes, everybody laughed. My wife laughed, my employees laughed, and it was a pretty good laugh here for about a month.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Sally Herships.
Have a great day.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com.
Time travel brings us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, block time. Block time is the time airlines say it'll take to get from one place to another. Summer travelers might be a wee bit surprised to learn the Earth is growing. Or at least that's what carriers must want you to think, because some routes are taking longer, sometimes 30 minutes longer than 10 years ago. What's the real deal? Many airlines are accounting for expected flight delays by changing their block times. Then they can tell regulators a flight that's 20 minutes late was actually on time. Hey, but at least their food is awesome.
Got a box full of letters.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tess McLund, and this is the time in the show when we turn the microphone around to hear from you. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, is here to help. Hey, Chris, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. But before we get into answering some questions, Let's ask everyone to take down our website address. It's marketplace.org. Click on the contact button there, or you can give us a call. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. All right, let's go to our first caller. Lucia is in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Lucia.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, and you?
I'm doing well.
Terrific. What do you do there in Boston?
I am a school teacher.
Oh, terrific. What age?
Fifth grade.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And what's your question for Chris today?
This is my question. We own a two-bedroom condominium outside of Harvard Square, and we would like to buy a larger home because we have a two-year-old, and we would like to keep this place as a rental property. So my father offered us some money to help us keep this place and buy a new place. So my father has given myself, my husband, and our two-year-old each $12,000, and my stepmother has also given us each $12,000. But our goal is $100,000. So my question is, can my father give the money to my 18-year-old brother and then have him gift it to us?
First of all, who do we have there in the background?
Can you hear
with
my
you?
Two-year-old?
Yes.
Yeah, he'd like more chicken nuggets. He's having fun.
Well, I certainly understand the need for chicken nuggets.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Well, when the money is gifted to your brother,
mm-hmm.
the way the gift works, he can then do whatever he wants with it. Okay? So it's his. And that's the only way it works. Nobody has any control over what he does with that money. Otherwise, it's disqualified by the IRS. But I have another suggestion to make. Parents are increasingly, or relatives, are increasingly doing also what's called a shared equity mortgage. Let's say, you know, let's just make it all simple. Let's forget about the gifts just for a moment. They lend you $100,000. You put that into the down payment. Then when you sell your place, you get your $100,000 back plus a share of the profits. One reason why I'm just mentioning this is that there are a lot of parents out there who are well off, but they're not wealthy. And a gift is a little more than they really want to afford, considering their overall estate planning and retirement planning. This is an option that says you can still help out your daughter or your son-in-law or whomever. You are helping them out. You're doing a real benefit for them. It's a legal document. But, you know, after 5, 7, 10 years, depending on whatever you negotiate, you know, they're going to get a little bit of return. And, you know, maybe they could have done better in the stock market, but they're not doing this to make a huge sum of money, but to get their $100,000 back plus some percentage of the appreciation in the property. It's not a bad deal for everybody.
Okay, so this is called a shared equity bridge
loan?
No,
a shared equity mortgage, shared appreciation mortgage. There's a number of different terms.
Chris, let me just go back and make sure for the audience that we understand that getting all of these $12,000 gifts from different family members and going to different family members, all of that is legal.
The only one, I mean, the one that you described, once you get to the 18-year-old brother, he can gift it. But again, remember, the parents can't gift it to him with the expectation that he's going to gift it to his sister. But if they gift him $12,000 and then he wakes up in the morning and says, I got a brilliant idea, I'm going to gift this to my sister. I don't see what would stop him.
All right. Does that help you, Alicia?
It does. It does. Thank you so much for your help. And sorry about all the background noise.
Not at all. Did your two-year-old have a question for us?
No, I think he's, yeah, he wants to know if he can feel free to be you and me.
Well, Chris, I'm going to speak for the two of us and say that the two-year-old may listen to Free to Be You and Me.
Okay, thank you. Okay, bye.
Thanks for the call. All right, Chris, well, you and me are free to answer more emails. You ready for this?
All right.
Here
can
we
I groan?
Go.
Can I groan a little bit on that one? I'd like to.
Yes,
thank you.
You have my permission. Frank wrote in from Crawford, Florida, and he's got some stock in a media/cable company called ION. And he was just notified that the company is offering to buy out all the stock. He's never been in this situation before. What should he do? If he doesn't take the offer, does he lose the stock anyway? Does it become worthless? What if everybody else takes the buyout and he's left all by himself? This is certainly not an uncommon thing to happen. So what's your advice?
It turns out ION is a media company, own about 60 television stations, and they're being bought out by NBC Universal and a private equity firm. And they got an offer there, and you just tender your stock, and you get your cash for however much stock you have, and then reinvest it in the market.
And it's not like there's an option of
not doing this, right?
No, there is no option. And, you know, for you and I and Frank, you know, we're just small investors. We don't really count. We go along for the ride. Now, maybe there's another hedge fund that will come along or another company that will come along and they'll say, we think that price is too low. We just go along for the ride.
All right. Well, there you go. Short and simple.
The investor relations department will send him all, and it sounds like he already has the information, but they send him all the information and how to do it, and all the brokerage houses know how to do it. So it's a fairly simple process.
All right. Well, there you go, Frank. Hope that helps. Have no fear, dear listeners. If you're completely in the dark about a financial situation, we're here to come to the rescue. Click on the contact button on our website, marketplace.org, or call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Let's go to the phones again. We've got Elizabeth on the line from Savannah, Georgia. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello.
How are things there in Savannah?
Quite warm right now. We're having a drought.
Are the magnolias out?
The magnolias have been out for some time, and some of them are dying because of lack of water.
Really? Oh, yes. How sad. Well, let's talk a little bit about your question for Chris today. I understand that you and your husband have lived in your home for a good amount of time. How long?
Almost 20 years.
20 years. Terrific. Mm-hmm. And you're close to paying it off. Good for you.
Yes.
So what is your specific question for Chris?
Well, you know, we've been on house tours of museum houses down here, where they show us that people in the old days used to buy a crystal ball or a clear ball and put it on the banister to show people that the mortgage had been paid when they came to visit. But we don't have a banister or stairs, and we also don't know what we are should be keeping to tell everybody, our daughter included, when she's older, what kind of mortgage she's inherited.
Okay, terrific. Well, Chris, I suppose the easy solution would be to buy a crystal ball.
I was just going to say, that's exactly. It's a happy day. I think that's one of the great days in the lives of most Americans when they get to own their home free and clear. There are two key legal documents that you signed when you were in that room signing all that stuff involving getting that mortgage. Do you remember that?
Yes. In fact, I have an inch and a half of it and wonder what to keep.
Wow.
Exactly. So, but there are two really key documents. One's called a promissory note and one's called a deed of trust. And what you want back from your lender is a marked documents that say, and it'll be stamped, paid and canceled. That's the phrase that you want. And the other thing is that paid and canceled phrase has to be recorded with the state. Some lenders are very good. And by the way, they'll let you know. Some lenders are very good and they'll contact the appropriate recorder of deeds. Other ones will say, congratulations, this is wonderful, you paid off your mortgage. Oh, by the way, don't forget to contact the recorder of deeds.
Oh, but they will tell me whether they've done it or not.
Exactly. So it's your obligation,
okay,
though, is to make sure the release from your mortgage is in the official records.
Chris, what about the actual title to the house? Do you get something in paper that says, congratulations, you own this thing free and clear?
That is really the, I said there's two documents, the promissory note and the deed of trust. What you're really talking about is that deed of trust.
Okay.
Deed of trust is the same thing as title then?
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
Yep.
I have to ask you, I've heard of people holding mortgage burning parties once they've paid off the house. Do you have any plans to celebrate somehow?
No, do not burn the mortgage. No. The moral conversation is don't burn the mortgage. Have it released.
I'll scan the mortgage and put it on a disc with the other things for when we have to flee from a hurricane.
Have everything recorded with the state. Have it released from the land records instead. You don't want to burn the mortgage.
All right. Well, maybe you can have a rain party, you know, and turn the sprinklers on.
I know, Tess, I rained in your parade.
But your water authority would be very displeased with me. So. Well, I hope that has helped you out with your question. And, Chris, I will take my slap on the hand and discourage anyone from ever having a mortgage burning party.
Thank you.
This is very helpful. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, Chris, as I said, I've heard of a lot of people who have these mortgage burning parties. And yes, you know, you don't burn every single piece of paper. You have to prove that you paid off your mortgage. But I'm going to issue a call to listeners to ask, if you have paid off your mortgage and you had a mortgage burning party, and then later on you tried to sell your house and you had trouble because you didn't have all the right papers, write in and let us know about that. We want to hear your stories. Well, most people are really concerned about getting rid of those pesky bills, including mortgages. But after you pay them off, what's next? Give us a call. We'll shed some light on it. It's 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or visit our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on the contact button. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, let's hit the email bag again. We've got Hiram writing in from Highland Park here in California, and he's done something quite commendable. He purchased a savings bond every payday for 25 years.
Whoa.
Can we give him a hand?
Absolutely.
Well done. Well done. He intended to roll over E and double E bonds to double H bonds, and we'll explain all this in a moment, to provide some retirement income.
You'll explain it in a moment. Yes, go ahead.
No, my friend, you will explain it. Now that double H bonds have been discontinued, what can he do with these bonds, some of which are maturing, to give him some income without getting taxed too hard? So first of all, let's talk about, very briefly, some of the differences between all these different kinds of bonds. What's an E versus a double E versus a double H?
All right, let's go with the E, the double E. That is your classic savings bond. You put down $25 and it's worth $50 over a period of time. You don't pay taxes until you cash it in.
What happened to A, B, C, and D?
I have no idea what happened to them, but let's go to the HH.
Okay, double H.
With the double H used to be, you would take your double E or your E, roll them over into H bonds, and what those were called current income securities. They would pay you an interest payment to maturity redemption. It was a way of getting income off of these things. And they discontinued. It's actually, I think, a good thing they discontinued them.
Why?
Well, it was so low.
Oh, the interest rate was so low?
You could just do so much better. It was sort of an older generation liked them because there was not a certain amount. There was a lot of security to them. But you really paid a big price. It was not a good deal.
All right. Well, Hiram was hoping to get into these double H bonds. They're no longer there. So what can he do with the E and double E's so that he can get some income without this big tax hit?
There's a little bit of tax management going on here. Mm-hmm. But I would be selling them for current income. You're going to buy a car, you know, whatever you sort of need your current income to maintain your standard of living. But you still get the time when you're going to pay the tax. If this is a good year for you to cash in some of the bonds and pay the tax, and you got a need there or your tax rate is very low, then go ahead and do it. And that's how I would use them. But you will be paying income taxes when you cash them in.
Well, good question. Thanks for that, Hiram. And unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. Please leave your question for a future program on our voicemail. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, M-O-N-Y. Or visit our contact page on our website. It's marketplace.org. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thanks a lot, Des.
For some homeowners, the busted housing bubble is a financial nightmare. For others, it could be the ticket to the home of their dreams. We raise our hands at a foreclosure auction up next. And business students learn the art of persuasion. Or is it manipulation?
I'd point out that you're manipulating me right now because you're smiling and you are at least feigning, if not expressing sincere interest.
You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Let me ask everyone a pretty simple question. By a show of hands, how many of you want a promotion? Well, okay, I can't see your hands, but I can imagine lots of them sticking up. Well, if you want that better job and all that comes with it, one way is to go back to school, business school. But you might be surprised to find a class other than finance and accounting on your schedule. You call it Persuasion 101, Alex Goldmark reports.
After more than 15 years as an entrepreneur, Matt Simmons still felt he needed brushing up on some of his business skills, especially the interpersonal ones, like negotiating.
I think that my approach up until then to negotiation had always been a fairly sort of haphazard, ill-prepared approach.
So he found a course on negotiation at Columbia's business school. The course drew on psychology and other social sciences to suggest better business moves, like try to make the opening offer when negotiating.
I think I was always far too timid to do that, but now found I had the confidence to go in and make an opening bid and really then sort of set the stall for the rest of that discussion. That meant that we achieved much greater value in some of our advertising campaigns. For example, I think that we improved some of the returns by 30 or 40%.
So you made more money then?
as a European, of course, we always shy away from that idea. But yes, in a very concrete way, both personally and for my company.
Professor Bob Bontempo of Columbia's Business School specializes in turning psychology into business profits. He taught that negotiation class, and now he's going to help students brush up on a new skill, persuasion. He says students wanted more than just negotiation.
It wasn't just negotiating transactions. It was that on a day-to-day basis, they're often in meetings where they need to be persuasive. They need to build consensus. They need to change people's minds. They need to overcome resistance to a change in strategy or implementation of a new initiative.
Bontempo says the key is understanding the psychology of the target of your persuasion. For instance, if you disagree with them too much, they'll reject everything else you say. But flat-out agreeing won't get you anywhere.
Second, you can train people how to fine-tune their message based on the type of person they're dealing with. Some people are swayed by a dramatic, vivid, colorful story. Other people want to see data and facts and figures.
I'm more swayed by trustworthy testimony and word of mouth, he tells me. Personally, I'm not so sure he pegged me right. I'll test it out the next time I buy a used car. But his course isn't just for salesmen. It's for their bosses, too. Chuck Wardell of the executive recruiting firm Korn Ferry says persuasion is critical for executives who have to sell their ideas to coworkers and motivate subordinates.
Persuading people that the business proposition is sound and that it's in our joint self-interest to work together to get it done is the art of leadership in corporate existence. It is the skill that you must have at a certain level.
So he says classes that focus on interpersonal skills are a helpful complement to the traditional business school regimen.
You have to have the analytical skills to understand what you're seeing and the pressures on you, but you have to have the leadership skills to get the end result in the marketplace.
Okay, but isn't teaching persuasion just manipulation boiled down to a science? Again, Professor Bob Bontempo.
People often raise issues about the ethics of persuasion as manipulation. And I'd like to simply point out that you're manipulating me right now because you're making direct eye contact with me and you're smiling and you're nodding and you are at least feigning, if not expressing sincere interest. And that's a very powerful way to get me to keep on talking and tell more stories.
Mm-hmm. Go on.
We're manipulating and influencing and persuading people all day long. I'm just trying to make people more effective at it.
And then they'll use it to make more money.
And I hope they use it to make the world a better place.
So, not just money?
But because I believe in market forces, I believe that that's one and the same thing.
A persuasive point, if I were persuaded by that kind of thing. In New York, I'm Alex Goldmark for Marketplace Money.
Want to learn more ways to get ahead at work? Climb the digital ladder to our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrive and Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
No question, it's a buyer's market in housing these days. Lots of homes for sale, and they're staying on the market longer. So there are bargains to be had, perhaps nowhere more so than at foreclosure auctions, which are popping up around the country. I attended one a couple of weeks ago at the Los Angeles Convention Center. It felt more like a party than an event made possible by people losing their homes. It was the second of three auctions held here in Southern California by Real Estate Disposition Corporation. More than 2,000 people packed into the convention hall to bid on 92 properties,
all owned by banks and other mortgage lenders left holding the bag.
Ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us today.
Before the auction got underway, the auctioneers made sure everybody knew the rules.
Now, you should have personally inspected all properties you are interested in purchasing. Each property is being sold as is, where is, and with all faults, with no guarantee or warranty whatsoever.
Getting a home at auction involves even more risk than the usual method of open houses and real estate agents. Buyers had just one weekend to view the properties and get any inspections done. But that didn't stop the frenzied bidding once the auction got underway, starting with a three-bedroom, two-bath home previously valued at $475,000.
Folks, here we go. Property item number one in L.A. It's 17619 Sierra Hill Street, Canyon Country. And its starting bid here, $259,000.
Let's sell the home at $259,000. Here we go. And now, $275,000 on it now. Who can be $300,000 on it now? $325,000, $50,000. Hit now, $350,000 to buy. Hit now, bid me $350,000 to buy. $375,000. Come along, $375,000. You both out. $400,000 to buy. Hit now, going to be $400,000 to buy. $375,000. Four. Hit now and again, $400,000 here. Now, $25,000. Hit now, $425,000 to buy. I'm bid for $25,000. Who said it? $425,000 with JJ in the back, and now $450,000. I'm bid $425,000. Who'll give me $450,000 now? $425,000. Anybody else at $450,000? Going once, going twice, and a half. Sold in the back at $425,000.
Property item number
The pace
two,
of the auction
two,
was breathtaking. Five homes sold within the first 8 minutes. Auction assistants in tuxedos raced around the room, pointing out buyers as the bids rose. Most of the winning bids at the Los Angeles auction weren't huge steals, usually within 20% or so of the original value. But the winner on the first property, Magdi Abuisa, wasn't complaining.
A few months ago, I wanted to buy some investment home, and I went and checked prices, and it was very high. In the auction, you have a potential, at least if it's not as it's claimed, you know, to be 50% of the price, it could be 70% of the price, which is okay for me.
So this is investment property for you? You're not planning to live in the home?
Well, I have an option. I might put one of my family in there, and or it could be a potential for sale.
Does it enter into your mind at all that you are able to purchase this house because someone wasn't able to afford it?
Yes, I do. And you know what? I sympathize with people when they lose homes. But for me to feel bad about it, I'm not the one who evicted him. You know, I'm the one who came and bought, and that's how it goes.
Abuisa was typical of many buyers at the auction, an investor hoping to get a good deal, then turn around and sell. Suzanne Holub made the winning bid on house number 14. She paid $370,000 for a four-bed, one-bath home previously valued at $455,000.
Well, I'm just going to buy it and flip it.
Even in this market, still doing the flipping.
You know why? Because I think there's some hidden value in the property because it's got a bigger lot than what they have put down.
Holub was meeting with a financing team when I spoke with her. After placing a winning bid, buyers were escorted to an area filled with lenders, offering some of the exact same mortgage products that got the original owners of those homes into trouble.
5-year ARM is fine because I'm probably going to flip it in, you know, hopefully 2-3 months. The lowest the payment, the better.
The lenders were also offering so-called low and no document loans, which don't require borrowers to prove their income.
Here we go, $250,000 to buy. Hit now, $250,000, $75,000. Hit me now, $275,000. Hit now, bid me $275,000, $300,000. Hit come along, $300,000 to buy now. Hey, let's see.
What buyers did have to bring with them was a $5,000 cashier's check, plus a personal check to cover the rest of a 5% down payment. Each winning bid also had a 5% premium tacked onto it by the auction company. So who shouldn't buy a house this way? I put the question to the chairman of the auction company, Rob Friedman.
I would say anybody who hasn't done their homework. I mean, you shouldn't come to an auction and just think you're going to, because you're smart, you're going to get a deal. You need to go out and look at the property, look at the comps, and come armed and educated. In today's marketplace, this is a fabulous way to buy a piece of property, and I think you will definitely save money. Again, I will say the best thing to do is to be knowledgeable.
In other words, no matter how festive and fast-moving it may be, don't come into a foreclosure auction thinking that getting the home of your dreams will be easy. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
like it's going to be the best
they
quarter
decide
for
what they're going to charge
that has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor, Chris Farrell, to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what's the straight story. And Chris, you know, it used to be you could ask any given American, are you better off than your parents? And the answer was always yes.
And that's as it should be, right?
But there's this new study out that says the response these days is often, no, I'm not better off than my parents. And that's a pretty serious change.
Yeah, this comes from a collaboration between the Pew Charitable Trust and members of four think tanks. And Tess, here's one striking thing they found. American men in their 30s today are worse off than their fathers were at the same age. Here's another. Okay, there is greater upward mobility in Canada, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Germany, and get this, France, than in the U.S.
Wow.
In other words, the odds are better here. If you're born rich, you'll stay rich. And if you're born poor, you'll die poor. Well, here's a straight story. This is an ominous trend. To reverse it, we need to create genuine ladders of opportunity for the disenfranchised and the disadvantaged.
I've always been under the impression that we had those ladders. What happened to them?
Part of it is back to the 50s and 60s when there was greater mobility. You know, we had limited competition in our economy. We had a social compact.
Mm-hmm.
We had strong unions, the GI Bill, Social Security, Medicare.
Those haven't gone away, though.
No, but we have now moved toward a society of hyper-competition, both domestically and internationally, this thing that we talk about a lot.
Mm.
We've also had deregulation, which is, you know, again, I'm not saying these things are all negative. What I'm saying is how the environment has changed. Yes, Social Security is a great program, but things like the Earned Income Tax Credit, best anti-poverty program that we've had, you know, the past couple of years, the movement has been, you know, well, how do we sort of cut into it?
You know, we hear a lot about income inequality. You know, even the president has even come out and said that it's gotten worse over the last quarter century or so.
Exactly.
How does economic mobility play into that issue?
Okay, here's how I look at the relationship between income inequality and economic mobility. Now, imagine a world, all right, let's just take the world we have, wide income inequality. But in this world, everyone believes that they have the same chance to get ahead, that there's equality of opportunity. There's not equality of outcome, but there is of opportunity. So parents work hard. They believe that their children will do better. A rising tide lifts all boats.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now imagine a world, same income inequalities we have now, but a rising tide only lifts a few yachts. In that world, parents don't work as hard, their kids don't have hope of doing better, and, you know, more than income inequality, it's the lack of a belief in equality of opportunity and economic mobility that leads to a stagnant, broken economy.
How do we fight against it? What's the biggest thing that society can do?
Two things. One is education. From birth through high school, particularly addressing the problems by people who drop out of high school or don't get a good high school education.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, we did it. The latter part of the 19th century, only 10% of Americans went to high school. And within a period of a few decades, most Americans went to high school. It was phenomenal. We built this economic engine on that one movement. So serious education reform. And the second, universal health care. Those two things alone will have a big impact.
Chris, we talk about this as an ominous trend, but this is really just one study, isn't it?
There's growing interest in this area. There's a lot of studies, and I'm going to shock you, Tress. There's some contradictory results. And let me just also draw one other cautionary note. Let's not get too nostalgic about the 50s and 60s, because economic mobility is much better for women these days. It's much better for African-American these days. But I'm distressed that we're living in a society where we have rising income inequality. And you know what? In the international competition between nations, I want us to have better upward economic mobility than a number of the other ones that I mentioned, like France.
The straight story from our man, Chris Farrell. Thanks so much, Chris.
You're welcome.
So my home is run by a border collie named Kiara. And like a lot of dog lovers, when I'm around her, I act, well, stupid. Baby talk, silly faces, big sloppy hugs. You know the routine. Well, it turns out con artists are well aware that a quick way to get us to turn off our brains is to show us a cute puppy. This week, the Better Business Bureau and the American Kennel Club issued a joint warning about a couple of new canine-centric internet scams. In one, the scammers set up fake websites to dupe you into thinking they're bulldog breeders. We asked the Bureau's Allison Pressler to tell us about the second.
They will post ads in the classified saying that they're missionaries and they're in Nigeria and their poor bulldog puppy just can't handle the heat. And they just want to find a good home for their baby. They like to call it their baby. And, you know, they're not going to charge anyone for the dog, but they want people to pay maybe $350 for shipping the dog to the state.
You wire the money, and guess what? Snookums never arrives. In other words, it's that old Nigerian internet scam plus puppies. Pressler says hundreds of people have fallen for these tactics, losing thousands of dollars at a time.
You will send them $250. They'll say, great, we got the money. Unfortunately, the dog is stuck in customs and I need $200 more to get the dog shots and to get the dog out of customs and to pay more fees. And as long as they keep getting money from you, they'll keep going back and trying to get more and more.
It's tough to sic the authorities on these scammers since they operate under fake names with fake email addresses. So, how to protect yourself?
First lesson to learn is never wire money to someone you don't know. Once you wire someone money, it's gone and you can't get it back. Another lesson is if you do want a purebred dog, try and go with a local breeder, someone that you can actually go to their facilities to make sure you can actually meet the dog first. Often you want to ask for references. Do your research.
Oh, and one positive note, no actual dogs were harmed in the perpetration of these scams, just wallets.
How much is that doggy in the window? The one with the waggly tail.
Oh, and that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof meets the recipient of his microloan.
He didn't know what the internet was. He'd never been on a computer. And, you know, all of a sudden I show up and I explain I'm his banker.
Surprise! If you missed any part of the show, no worries. We've got a podcast at marketplace.org. While you're there, check out the new Money Clip video. Chris has some advice on managing credit card debt. Marketplace Money is produced by Wendy Sykes with Rico Galliano, Nancy Fargali, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Philippi, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. See you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, introducing ThriveQ, an online tool that helps you know where you stand on your path to retirement in about 10 minutes. What's your ThriveQ? You can learn more at ThriveQ.com.
American Public Media.